Hey, listeners, this is Melody. Thank you for the reviews you've been sending in. They are really helping us. And it's been very exciting to see where everyone is listening from. Even our listeners in Germany who haven't missed an episode yet. We would love to know how you heard about us, so feel free to reach out on social media. Okay, Darlene's telling the story today, and you know what that means. It's going to be a graphic one. She seems to cover the especially bloody ones. And today's episode is no exception. So don't listen around the kids. This is Hard Times and True Crimes.
Today, we're going to take y'all to Bibb County, Georgia, about 12 miles west of Macon. And this is an old one, all the way back from the 1800s. As the Civil War ends and the Reconstruction era begins, while the northern states are experiencing a second industrial revolution, the South, including Georgia, was still picking up the pieces of their war-torn states. And those were some hard times to be a Southerner. Many former plantation owners who had depended on slave labor before the war lost the farm, literally. Some found ways to keep their land by working out deals with poor whites and ex-slaves, who became sharecroppers, farming the land for a portion of the crop profits and a shack to live in. The sharecropping system was supposed to be a benefit to ex-slaves who had nowhere to go, and the farmers who were desperate for laborers, and the economy, which depended on the crops being grown. The system halfway worked. Sometimes. Some landowners slowly prospered, but often ended up going under anyway. The economy was so bad nobody in the South could afford to buy the cotton or tobacco they were growing. No matter how good or bad business was for the landowner, the sharecroppers remained in perpetual poverty. You can believe there was unrest in the air. Tension between ex-slaves and landowners, northerners and southerners, the rich against the poor. But then something happened in Bibb County. Something bigger than ordinary day-to-day troubles. Something so terrible, it brought journalists from all over the country to write about it. In 1887, 5 years before Lizzie Borden, there was Bloody Wolfhook, who was accused of taking an axe to his father and 8 other family members. Wolfhook, Wolfhook, see what you've done. You've murdered your whole family and never fired a gun.
I've got quite a story for you today.
I'm excited to hear it.
So before I get into it, I wanted to cite my sources. My favorite articles are from the Atlanta Constitution, from the journalist who covered the actual story. He was there when they arrested the suspect. This was the largest mass murder in Georgia history.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a big deal. So it was printed in newspapers, not only in Georgia, but all over the United States. I also read the book Shadow Chasers, which was told from a different perspective than most of the newspaper articles I read.
Okay.
So if you want to go back and research this case, I recommend both. So let's get started with Richard Wolfhook. Richard Wolfhook. So the name is spelled Wolfhook, but it's pronounced Wolfhook. You know, our Southern, we like to pronounce things our own way.
That's going to trip us up probably through the whole program. That's okay.
Okay, so he was born in Bibb County, Georgia in 1835. Richard's dad was a wealthy plantation owner and sent his son to college at the University of Georgia in Athens. So they're pretty well off to be able to do that. He graduated in 1854, and that same year, he married 13-year-old Susan Moore. Yeah, that's hard to believe there was a time when 13-year-olds got married.
Yes, it is.
And that's still a baby. But Richard was 19, so he was, I'm glad he was still somewhat young. But according to every source, Richard loved Susan. He was a good husband to her. He had inherited a farmhouse on 80 acres of a cotton plantation. This was pre-Civil War, so they did own slaves who worked the plantation. Richard was a well-respected gentleman, especially with the white upper-class society. In 1855, when Susan was 14, she gave birth to their first baby, a little girl, and they named her Fluoride.
Fluoride? Yeah. Thought you were going to say Flora.
No, Fluoride. That's okay. Weird. But they called her Flo.
Okay,
thankfully.
Good.
Poor thing. Then they had another little girl they named Lily. And in 1860, they finally had their little boy named Tom. In 1861, though, just a year, well, not even quite a year after Tom was born, the Civil War broke out. His dad had to head off. He had to go off to war. So he left home, and he actually became a captain of the Georgia State Troops in the Confederate Army. Sadly, in 1885, his wife and the mother of his children passed away.
Oh, that is tragic. And she was young.
She was really young. I think she was like 24.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was terrible. It was just it was a really hard time. And the captain and his kids, of course, they were heartbroken. Mm-hmm. The war had ended that same year, but he'd returned to Macon being under martial law and just devastated by the war.
Mm.
Did you know that the South was under
I did not.
Yeah, I didn't know that until researching this case either. That's crazy. So he sent his daughters and his son to Athens to live with his wife's sister, Fanny. And she loved her nieces and nephew. And they loved her. Mm-hmm. And they did for the rest of their lives. She was like a mom to them. She would entertain the kids by telling them stories about their mom's childhood and about their heroic pa, the captain.
Aww.
And Tom wanted to be just like his dad. In 1867, the captain remarried. His new bride was 21-year-old Mattie Howard. Her daddy, Ben Howard, was a well-off businessman and a deacon of the Mount Zion Baptist Church. And Mattie wasn't daddy's girl.
Mm.
She was her father's only daughter, and he even sent her to college, which was pretty rare.
Yeah, back then.
Yeah, for girls at that time. When they were married, the captain was only 32.
But she was 21, right? Yeah. I think he had, like, I don't know, he liked younger women, apparently.
He did, but I think that was common.
Common, I think so, too.
Yeah, I think that was just
in that era.
The going thing. Yeah. So he was still pretty young at 32 to have gone through all that. I mean, he's already fought a war, lost a wife. But shortly after their marriage, they sent for the kids to come back and live with them in their childhood home on the plantation.
Okay, so they were with their aunt, and now they're back home.
Now they're back home.
Okay.
Yes. So Tom, being the youngest, he actually adjusted well in the beginning. He didn't really have a hard time accepting Mattie. But the girls, it took them a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they remembered their mom in that same house.
Yes. And that's hard. You know, the women of the house, and I would have a hard time with that.
Oh, I would too, for sure. So it did take them a little bit longer, but, you know, they eventually grew to love and accept her. She was pretty good to them. Of course, pretty soon the babies started coming for the captain and Mattie. The first was Richard Jr., which they nicknamed Dick, and then Pearl. And next was Annie, Rosebud after her. Charlie was next, and then finally baby Mattie.
Woo!
Yeah.
That's a lot of kids.
They had a slew. As the kids kept coming, though, Tom's relationship with his stepmom soured. He was openly jealous of his half-siblings. He was obsessed with money and getting an inheritance from his father. And he was terrified that his dad's new family stood in the way of him getting what he felt was rightfully his. He was the firstborn son, and he just felt like he was entitled to his father's money and that those kids were not. And he was also pretty vocal about that. He didn't try to hide his disdain.
Oh, goodness.
So I think his hatred was mostly directed at the older kids, though, Dick and Pearl. I'm pretty sure the feeling was mutual, because as they got older, you know, they'd kind of argue back with him, and he'd try to bully him, and, you know, it didn't work.
Yeah.
They were getting older, so they'd be like, you're a loser. So his stepmom, though, she tolerated him for the sake of her husband. But Tom was just a difficult person to be around. I mean, we've all met those people.
Yeah.
I mean, he was not pleasant.
And when you have blended families, you know how that can be. And so if you've got one who's just refusing to get along with the rest of the family, you can see a whole host of problems that stem from that.
Oh, yeah. And when they're hateful to you and they're hateful to your kids, I mean, that's hard.
Yeah.
I feel like if I was a stepmom, me and the captain would be having some words until he set his son straight about how to treat me.
Yeah.
And you better believe that I'd be defending my kids, too. Especially, he was a grown behind man at that point.
Oh, goodness. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No. At the same time, I can feel for him, especially in his younger years. I think Tom was jealous about a lot more than money. Mm. He was desperate for the captain's love and approval. And it was probably hard for him to watch his dad be there and nurture these kids, knowing that, you know, he and his sisters had been sent away when they were young. And then, he was watching them grow up with a loving mother. And Tom didn't really know his mother very well because she died when he was like 5 years old. But he had some connection to her. It seemed like her death really affected him. She was buried on the plantation and he spent a lot of time at her grave. He was dealt some tough blows early in life. And we all know that hardships like that can make or break us.
Yes. And it sounds like his turned into resentment.
Yeah. Yeah. And he, I think he felt like a victim his whole life.
Oh, yeah.
Tom was aggravating, but despite what he believed, I think the captain did love him. He tried his best to help him become a successful businessman. One time, Tom wanted to lease his own plantation, and his dad gave him the money to help him get started. He worked and tried for about 2 years to make a self-sustaining farm, but it failed, and he eventually had to give up. After that, his dad gave him money to start a grocery store. So he opened up his own grocery store, but that wasn't successful either. Then it was a liquor store that went under. He wanted so much to prove himself to his dad, but he was just having a rough time. So finally, he decided to go out to Texas and he was going to become a real cowboy.
Oh, goodness.
But a few months later, he was back with his tail tucked between his legs. He tried two or three more times to start up businesses, and they, of course, all ended in failure.
And was his father, providing the money for those every time?
Yes. He didn't have any means to really support himself.
Yeah. So there's a pattern already.
Yes.
Yeah.
There is. And times were hard. The economy was in terrible shape after the Civil War. It may not have been super easy to start up a business, but that poor feller, he couldn't even hold down a job working for somebody else.
Oh, goodness.
I mean, he liked to drink. Mm. He had an abrasive personality. He had a victim mentality. He was rude. He would fight, argue, and he cussed all the time. Yeah. And cussing back then was not okay.
Right. And, anytime you work for someone else, if you have a victim mentality, that's not going to go well. You're not going to be a good employee.
No.
So, you know, I'm already getting this mental picture of who Tom is.
He, like, showed off his name a lot.
Right.
Like, I'm the captain's son.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm somebody, you know. So, yeah, it didn't work because they fired him.
Good.
Finally, though, his dad had to tell him he could not give him any more large sums of money. And this infuriated Tom.
Oh, I'm sure it did.
He blamed, of course, his half-brothers and sisters and his stepmom.
Everybody else.
Right. Yeah. It was not his fault. Tom was thinking, though, that if he could just prove that he was worthy of the captain's inheritance, that his dad would set him up financially for the rest of his life. And he was fixated on making that happen. That was his number one goal.
Wow.
So when Tom was 27 years old, he cooked up a plan to find a wife for himself.
Cooked up a plan. Now, yeah. That's interesting.
He thought the captain would be more likely to be generous with him if he was married, and had a dependent.
Yeah, another heir.
So that just gave him another opportunity to prove himself. Tom went to Jones County and he met a little girl named Georgia Bird. She was 17. He put on a big show for her. He flashed that name around. He bragged about how wealthy his father was. And the captain, he was a big deal. Mm-hmm. So everybody knew who he was. And Tom told Georgia that he would be inheriting the captain's fortune. And he proposed to her.
Okay. So was he really going to inherit, or he was just like, I mean, I'm sure he would have gotten some. Is he like acting like, oh, I'm going to inherit this whole thing?
Yeah. No. Yeah. He was acting like he was.
And he thinks he deserves the whole thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I think he believed somehow he was going to make that happen.
He was the firstborn son, so he was going to get it all.
He told her that if she married him, that they'd go back and have their own house on the plantation. He made out like she'd be living first class.
Oh, goodness.
If she would agree to marry him. George's parents, they did not like it. They knew he had a well-to-do dad. I mean, everybody knew that. They had also heard rumors about Tom, though, and his relationship with his family. And they thought Tom was just kind of a loser.
And they could see through him, it sounds like. I mean,
right.
They, yeah.
He was weird. But you know, when it comes to romance, kids think their parents are like clueless.
Oh, yeah. And if mom and dad don't want me to marry this person, I am for sure going to marry him.
Exactly. So, and she couldn't see that she had anything to lose. It wasn't like today where everybody was marrying for love.
Mm-hmm.
So she thought, hey, I want to be fixed up. It all seemed plausible to her. She knew that he was the captain's son and he was the oldest son.
It was going to set her in a better position in life.
So she boarded a train to Macon with Tom, and they were married in transit on the train.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. He found a preacher right there on the train. They sit up in the aisle of a moving train.
I'm glad Tom was able to find a preacher on that train. And when my husband and I got married, we grew up watching Love Boat. We had always heard that if you're in international waters, that the captain of a ship can marry you.
Right.
So we had bought a trip to the Bahamas. My husband was so sweet. He proposed to me on the train on the way over to catch the boat. We got on the boat and he goes to the captain of the ship and asks him, can he marry us? And he pretty much laughed in our face. He said, no, I do not have the authority to do that. And my husband was like, I've always heard that. He said, yeah, you heard wrong.
That is hilarious.
So we had to wait until we got to the island and get married at the courthouse there. Still lovely wedding, but yeah, that didn't happen for us. So Tom's got, you know, he's
right.
Got the preacher, he's got the train, he's good to go.
he made it happen.
He did.
He kind of had to because he didn't want her to, you know, to get there and then realize she'd been duped.
Yeah, he got to get her locked in before that happens.
So when they got to Macon, you know, she was all excited to start her new life and see her new house.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, but poor thing. He took her right to his sister Flo's house. Because, I mean, he didn't have a home to take her to or any way to support her.
He took her to Flora. Yes. Flora's house.
My ma used to say that he didn't have a pot to
piss in.
Or a window to throw it out. And that was poor Tom.
Yeah.
And also, he was hateful to Georgia. He didn't really do much to, I guess he thought they were married so he could show his true colors.
Mm-hmm.
So he was mean to her.
Yeah.
And he was mean to his sister.
Oh, I can imagine. I mean, he always had been.
Yeah. He'd like fly into rages over the slightest thing. Georgia was scared of him.
Mm.
She also said that he talked bad about the captain, his stepmom, and of course, his half siblings. She said that he told her, Georgia, father has not fixed me up and I'm going to burn the family.
Oh my goodness. He sounds a little cray cray.
Yeah.
It honestly sounds to me like when his dad went off to war when he was younger, his mom probably did not discipline him a lot. She passed away. He lives with the aunt. The poor kid's lost his mom. She's not disciplining him. And he sounds like a grown man throwing tantrums.
He was the baby. And so he was babied by sisters.
Oh, he was the oldest son, but he was not the oldest child. He was first three. So everybody has coddled him, and now he's spoiled rotten.
That's exactly the case. He also said, father is rich and has got plenty, and if I can't get it, none of the others shall get it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
He means business.
She lasted a whole 3 weeks before she called her folks to come get her.
Mm-hmm.
And they did.
Yeah, that was a good call on her part.
Now, throughout his life, though, he stayed close to his Aunt Fanny. She was the closest thing he had to a mother, and she loved him.
Right.
He'd go back and forth to Athens pretty often to visit her. But over a span of about 3 years, she noticed her sweet nephew changing. He became paranoid. He was mean. He kept his lamp burning all night long. He'd talk like incoherently to himself and pace the floors. Can you imagine? Like hearing that, I would be terrified.
I was going to say earlier, it does sound like he may have some mental illness. And now it really sounds like truly he has some mental illness.
Yeah. And that could have progressed because I had heard earlier on, he was really close with some of his younger half siblings.
Okay.
You know, there may have always been some tension with the older ones, but it doesn't seem like that was the case with some of the younger ones.
Okay.
Later, though, his aunt said that if she and his sisters were having a conversation that Tom wasn't in earshot of, he'd get mad and accuse them of talking about him. He got to where he carried a gun around with him, thinking somebody was going to kill him.
Mm.
He even told his aunt and the captain that his older sister, Flo, who he stayed with a lot, was scheming against him. He got really aggressive with her a lot. And he stayed with her a lot when he was down on his luck, which seemed pretty often.
Yeah.
And she was afraid of him, too, but she also loved him. And she felt sorry for him. That was her little brother. And she just didn't feel like she could turn him away. So his aunt and sisters, they tried to tell the captain about their concerns that Tom was, you know, losing his mind. But he kind of shrugged it off. He actually kind of laughed it off and was like, he's not crazy, you know. It sounds like he definitely had some mental illness going on. Or he was just mean. But I don't know. If he was paranoid like that.
Fine line, right?
Yeah. So eventually, you know, he had to make a living somehow. So he went back to the plantation and the captain put him to work, you know, but he wasn't getting special treatment this time. He was a hired hand on the farm and he was making $9 a month like the rest.
Oh, wow.
The farm hands, yeah. And I can imagine that would be humbling or humiliating, depending on how you chose to look at it.
Mm-hmm. And he sounds like he would have chosen humiliating.
Right. His sister Pearl is going to an expensive college. His half-brother was set. And here was Tom, you know. And I'm sure those repeated failures, you know, they probably were tough on him. He thought he was destined to follow in his dad's footsteps. And now here he is working as a hired hand instead. So there's conflicting testimonies about how things went with Tom and the family during that time. His sister, who loved him a lot, said that the family all got along well during that time. But Tom's stepmom confided in her dad that one day in a fit of rage, Tom had threatened to send her straight to hell. Others say his little brother, Charlie, followed him around everywhere and thought the world of him. And if that's the case, then Tom must have earned that affection somehow. But then there was a sharecropper named John Owens who claimed Tom told him that the property belonged to him and he meant to have it. His aunt is the one that kind of described his craziness and paranoia, and she loved him.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll never know exactly what happened in the weeks leading up to August 6th, 1887. But that morning between 2 and 4 a.m., Tom ran to the closest neighbor, and that happened to be the shack of Green Lockett, a black sharecropper who worked for the captain. Tom told him to come quick that his father was being killed.
Mm.
He wanted Lockett to go back to the house with him, but he was not going to that house with Tom by himself.
Okay, so he already kind of was a little skeptical of Tom.
Yeah, and that was 20 years after the Civil War, and racial tensions were high in the South, and there was a deep mistrust between ex-slaves, you know, these sharecroppers, and landowners and farmers.
Understandably so.
Green Lockett, he just kind of wanted to mind his own business. Mm-hmm. And he didn't want to be anywhere that he could get himself into trouble or be blamed for anything. You think about it.
Yeah.
He was a black man. And if it turned out that somebody was dead,
who's going to get blamed?
Exactly.
He would be an easy mark to blame.
He sure would have. So he was like, no, I'm not doing that. So he sent his son to the nearest white neighbors for help. And then another sharecropper, Anderson James, wandered up because, you know, he heard the dogs barking and the cows bellowing in the fields and people hollering. He wanted to know what all the commotion was about. And he said he'd go with Tom. All three of them like headed down there. But as they got down there, it was pitch black and the house was eerily quiet. Anderson was like, you know what? I don't think I'm going to go in there either.
Mm.
So Tom went in by himself to check on his family. He was in the house alone for about 10 minutes When he came back out, he told them that all 9 people in the house were dead.
Oh, goodness. All 9.
All 9. Soon, the nearest white neighbors, the coroner, and the sheriff were there. When Tom told them that his family were all dead, they decided to wait until daybreak to go in the house. And, I mean, it was dark, and they were like, well, there's nothing we can really do until daybreak. None of them had, apparently none of them had, like, anything to shed any light. Nobody would go in that house.
Wow.
Until daybreak. Except for Tom.
So, Darlene, did they ask him, like, how are you the one that got out of there while the other 9 have been killed?
Yes, actually they did. While they were waiting for, you know, day to break.
Right.
They were like, so what happened? And Tom said that in the middle of the night, he heard his pa yelling. He said that it was really dark, but that he went in to see what was going, he was going to go see what was going on. So as he was kind of, you know, getting his bearings and thinking, okay, let me go in there and check on my pa, his half-brother Dick ran past him and went into his parents' room. And then he said he heard his brother get hit and fall.
Oh, goodness.
So at that point, he jumped out the window and ran for help.
And was he limping from jumping out the window or?
No, nope. And now I do think it was like a one. So I don't know that he would have.
Okay.
Yeah. Tom's matter-of-fact demeanor had not prepared them. Some of these men had fought in, you know, these bloody battles in the Civil War, but this scene was almost too much to handle. Some of them got physically sick.
Oh.
They said the smell of blood was, indescribable. The family had been axed to death.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
There was blood all over the walls. There was blood, like, conjugating. Did I say that word
right? Yeah, congealing.
Conjugating. There was blood congealing, like, in puddles. A 20-year-old Dick and 5-year-old Charlie were found on the floor of their parents' bedroom.
Oh, that's awful. So they had gone in there to help or to something.
Check, yes.
Oh.
And 16-year-old Pearl, she was home on summer break from college, and her bloody corpse was laying across the foot of her mom and dad's bed.
Oh.
So the captain and his wife's bodies were in the beds. In between them was their murdered little baby girl.
Oh, oh, goodness. Yeah. Oh.
There was blood and brain matter, like, all over the room. In another room, they found 2 more bodies. The first was Temperance West, Maddie's 84-year-old aunt, who was visiting her niece for a few days.
Mm.
And beside her was 7-year-old Rosebud.
Oh, the one you're telling about the kids is just, like, too much. I can hardly take it.
I know. The scene was just as gory as the last.
Mm.
But the saddest of all to me was when they found 10-year-old little Annie. She was found slumped down under a window with one of her arms still up on the windowsill.
Like she was trying to climb out?
Yes.
Oh.
So she knew exactly what was going on. And she came close to getting away.
Yeah.
But the killer found her. And
so maybe she could have even been the last one that was trying to get out.
Yep. They also found an axe at the scene. Suspicion immediately fell on Tom.
Right.
I mean,
it had to.
Yeah. Bloody footprints, they were found all over the house, and Tom admitted they were his.
Well, and the fact that he was the only one who was not killed is a big red flag.
That is exactly that's what they said, too. Like, okay. He somehow miraculously made it out when all the family, you know, were killed. And they even said if it were the defense used this later, not the defense, the prosecution said if this were somebody else, like a random... Why they would not have needed to kill the baby?
Right. Why would you? Exactly. Though it has to be, it sounds like it's very much, what is it they say when there's like a real heinous crime that's extremely gory, that usually it's like a crime of passion or a crime of that you know the person.
Yes, yes. And too, in this case, the motive was if everybody was dead,
then he inherits.
Right.
And you've already explained how much he thought he deserved to inherit.
And everybody knew that.
Okay. I just thought of another question. But his wife has already gone. She's gone back to her parents. Yes. She was not there.
No.
Okay.
Now, he said that those footprints, you know, I already told you about those bloody footprints. And he said that they were from when he went in the house in the dark and checked each of the bodies to see if they were still breathing. And he also had specks of blood in his ear. And, you know, blood spotters mm-hmm. when, you know.
I'm not buying his story like one bit.
And so, yeah. He said that the house was so bloody, he was checking everybody, that of course he was going to get blood on him. He even had a bloody handprint on his thigh. Now, he said he got sick on his stomach after he, you know, went in and saw the crime scene, and that he went out to the bathroom. His bowels were loose.
Oh, he said that.
Yeah. And so he went out to the outhouse to use the bathroom, and he said maybe because he had blood on his hands that he somehow put the handprint there. But I feel like that would be easily proven.
Could they match that up?
That's what I was thinking. So like that bloody handprint seemed to be a big deal in the prosecution's case. So anyway, he said there was just no way of avoiding getting that. He actually said, too, that he moved Pearl's body and put her on the bed.
Oh, he admitted to doing that?
Yeah, he did. He said that when he was checking on her, that he moved her body. Maybe like saying, like, I was checking on her.
And I was trying to help. She was,
yeah, it was that kind of thing. So he moved her body. To me, this was a really damning piece. I feel like he could almost explain away most of those other things. But this to me was, this did not look good. There was a lot. Well, actually, this is not the most damning.
Okay.
Scratch that.
But at this point in the story, it is? Yeah,
at this point.
Okay.
So there was a large spot in the room that he shared with his brothers that had clearly been scrubbed with soap and water. Now, he admitted that he had washed some of the blood off of himself, but he said that he did that out back at the well. And he said that spot was from the night before when he had taken a basin of water and washed and shaved. And they were like, okay, well, why is it still wet?
Right.
And he was like, I don't know. But it is. Like, he's oh, like, no. That's what happened.
Yeah. Sorry, so, Tom. Nobody's buying this story.
And there was no forced entry into the home. Now, I don't know how common it was to lock your door back then. Hmm. I mean, we didn't lock our doors growing up.
I don't even sit inside during the day with my doors unlocked.
I'm like that now just because, well,
probably because we're doing all the time. Yeah.
Probably because of this, I'm now like, I'm checking those doors
yeah.
a lot more often. Anyway, and there, okay, so nothing was stolen either. Robbery wasn't a motive.
Tom's just not very smart.
Right.
Because he sure didn't cover up anything that made him look guilty right from the get-go.
Now, this was crazy. So, when Tom was offered a drink of water from the well, he wouldn't drink it. Later, they found out that he had stripped his bloody clothes and thrown them in the well.
Oh, my goodness.
But earlier, he said he couldn't remember what he had done with them, with his clothes.
That, oh, my goodness.
Like, so everybody was, like, mad because they yeah. were all drinking the water.
Oh, my gosh. That's...
And then they found out, like, it was contaminated with human blood. Blood. So, yeah, oh. they were mad.
Yeah. And that story just gets more unbelievable as he tells it.
Right.
Like, I didn't do it, but I threw my bloody clothes in the well.
Yeah, it was just weird.
Yeah, all of it's weird.
So Tom, and he did not act like someone whose family had been murdered. He wasn't crying. He wasn't really acting sad. I mean, he was just kind of like matter-of-factly going through the facts. He could have been in a state of shock. Because I know now they're real careful not to...
Well, they don't just assume guilt by the way you act. I mean, sometimes it is a red flag, but not always. There have been people recorded who did not commit the crime, who did not have the response that you would normally expect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, anyway, but Tom just... He was off. Like, something just did not seem right with him. Before the coroner's jury made a decision whether Tom was going to be charged with that murder, with those murders, the sheriff went ahead and arrested him. And that probably saved his life because the people were ready to lynch him.
Oh.
Yeah.
I guess this was during a time of history where that was not uncommon,
no,
I'm sure.
No, it was not. So the captain and his family were well known. News travels fast.
Yes.
So there was like 1,000 or more people out wow. there on that property. So if they decided they were going to lynch him, there was no way the sheriff could have stopped mm-hmm. it.
No.
After the investigation, the coroner's jury decided, of course, they were going to charge him. Mm-hmm. Tom's sisters, they believed in his innocence, though. They were heartbroken over the death of their family.
So, okay, his sisters, they were not in the house. These are grown sisters.
Yeah.
His full-blooded sisters.
Yes.
And they probably are already married and out of the house.
They are.
And they believe him.
They believed him. Yeah.
I feel like they have to be in denial.
Yeah, you would think.
I would think. Okay.
They stood by him the whole time.
Okay.
But they also, like they were saying that at the funeral, that the sister Flo, that mm-hmm. she just cried. Like everybody felt sorry for her. I mean, mm-hmm. she was devastated. I mean.
Well, she's lost her family.
Right.
And her brother is going to be charged with it.
Exactly. So, and we already know she loves Tom. So his trial began on December 5th, 1877. And, you know, Tom continued to behave like Tom. He seemed like he was bored and unbothered by the whole thing.
Wow.
Although he emphatically claimed he was innocent and he seemed genuinely shocked when people thought he was guilty. Yes. He was like, I cannot believe that you would think I would murder my own pa. And my mom, like he was just thrown off by it. And they said, too, people would come into the jail. Because back then, you could just go into the jailhouse and they would they just wanted to catch a glimpse of him.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Like you could just go into the jailhouse just to see who's locked up and.
Yes.
Like a freak show kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
So they were like going in and stare. I mean, to the point where he's like, can you please get these people out of here.
Yeah.
It was really bothersome.
That's
and then reporters would come in, like that guy that I said that I enjoyed reading his articles, and he would be like, Tom, did you kill your entire family?
He's the journalist. And he'd yes. go, oh, my goodness.
And Tom, he gave him some interviews.
Okay.
So, yeah. There were obviously no firsthand witnesses to the crime, so the case was all circumstantial, but it took less than 15 minutes for the jury to find him guilty.
Yes, I'm sure.
And he was sentenced to hang. Now, he was given a second trial, and one of the reasons was because the judge didn't stop when the spectators in the court were chanting, hang him, hang him,
oh, my
hang
goodness.
Him. Yeah.
If I had been in there, I think I would have been probably saying like that a part myself. Of that. Yeah, probably.
So, whether he, you know, whether he did it or not, I don't think he got a fair trial because the judge, too, wouldn't let Tom's lawyers bring in witnesses because he would say, no, that's hearsay. But the prosecution had over 100 witnesses.
Oh, so it sounds like the judge might have been a little bit already.
Oh, yeah. He was biased.
Assuming guilt instead of innocence.
Right. And we do know that everybody deserves a fair trial.
Right.
So he
Although,
got a new trial.
I've already made up my mind.
Everybody else had yeah. to. So after that, though, he got a new trial and they allowed him to move his trial to another county. They changed the location to a different county, but Tom was still found guilty and he was still sentenced to hang. Now, in the new trial, I will say some witnesses came forth. You know how I told you those bloody clothes mm-hmm. were found? Well, actually, there was a lady she was a maid before, you know, a live-in maid for mm-hmm. the Wolfork family, and she said that the socks were not his, that they were actually her son's.
Hmm.
Yeah. And that the shirt that they also had found in there was, like, she knew those shirts, those are not the same shirts. Now, it was determined, I think, that it was actually his brother's shirt, and they were like, okay, so I'm sure y'all shared clothes. Y'all are close to the same age. And they were like, well, how did they get the blood on him? Well, I don't know. If something was thrown down there or if he washed up.
Yeah. But he had admitted that he had put his clothes in there. Didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah. No. He did not. He said he didn't remember.
Oh, he did. Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
So her testimony may have helped him slightly, but
may
not
have helped
enough.
Him slightly. I mean, some of it I can see. Some of his things, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. Like he was saying with the footprints. I mean, he did go from room to room. I mean, his footprints are going to be there. He's going to have blood. There was a lot of blood.
Yeah.
That seems plausible to me. But anyway, the jury was like, no, he's still guilty. And apparently he still wasn't fazed because he read a book throughout the majority of the second trial.
Oh, my word. So he's sitting in his trial reading a book. His life hangs in the balance.
Yeah, he wasn't doing much to bolster his public image. That's for sure.
That just amazes me.
People did not like him. But he did still swear that he was innocent. They tried to appeal that guilty verdict, but it was upheld this time. Like, they're like, no, you know, you're gonna pay.
Yeah.
So while Tom was in prison awaiting execution, a black man by the name of Jackson DeBost claimed that he had actually been at the Woolfolk house while the murders were taking place.
Why was he there?
He gave some conflicting stories. At first, he was kind of bragging that he had been in the house. And he was like a part of it, but he didn't do any of the killing, is what he said. But then he changed his story. He just happened to be out in the captain's yard picking apples, stealing apples, at about 2 or 3 in the morning when Green Lockett's wife and another black man went around to the back of the house. He said that Tom unlocked the door and let them in, and that the three of them had committed the murders while he was outside.
Oh, my goodness. I have so many questions, but I'm not going to ask them yet because I'm sure you're getting ready to cover them. But so many questions.
He said that he actually saw Tom jump out of his window and run down to Lockett's shack.
So he confirmed his story that he climbed out the window.
That's what he said.
Who's he telling this to? The authorities or?
The authorities. But you have to understand that this was a highly publicized case.
Mm-hmm.
So that fact,
it's not something that he didn't have any way of knowing unless he really was present. He could have read it anywhere.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. He was kind of a little bit crazy. I don't know if he really was crazy or if he was pretending to be. But some of his stuff was off. They asked him how the murders were committed. And he said that by a bomb.
Oh.
Yeah. So it was just really weird. Actually, he was briefly arrested and charged with accessory to murder. But then they decided that he was insane and sent him to an asylum.
Okay. So that is a question I have. Why would he, like, if that guy has already been convicted of this, why would he say that? Had the conviction already happened?
They didn't find him to be credible. And you know, we know today that people are like serial confessors.
Oh, yes.
Which is so weird. But it was interesting to me that he said, kind of keep that in your back pocket, that he was outside and that two other people went in.
Okay.
Okay. On October 28th, Tom stayed up until about 2 a.m. visiting with his sisters. They had a hard time saying goodbye to their brother. There were a lot of tears. Tom actually went to bed that night and was like, look, I have one request. Let me sleep in the morning.
Okay, because he was going to be hung?
Yes.
Okay. And
because, you know, it was kind of a frenzy over there with him.
Yeah.
So when he woke up the next morning at around 8, he gave an interview to a reporter and he was like cheerful.
Huh.
Yeah, it was really weird. He was kind of just in a, I don't know, cheerful mood, optimistic, he seemed. He came out and said, I expect I'll die today, and I hope I'll meet it like a man.
Hmm.
Yeah. He was propping his foot up on the wood stove, smoking a cigar.
Oh, my.
In true Tom fashion, nonchalant as ever.
I'm always amazed at these stories that we've told so far that the people are facing their death and they can just act so nonchalant. I mean, I don't know how you would act in that situation, but it's just, that's weird.
It is. He said he was looking forward to a hearty breakfast. I do think it was important to him to meet it like a man. He did not want to show a lot of emotion.
Yeah.
He told the reporter that he didn't have any statements to make other than he was innocent. He had a bath and he shaved and was given a new suit of clothes. Then he spent over an hour with a minister who prayed and read to him. Tom told the minister, and I quote, I'm an innocent man, and God ain't going to punish a man for what he ain't never did.
Hmm. Wow, that almost makes me feel a little sorry for Tom.
I know.
You know, I'm so convinced that he's guilty, but I don't know. That makes me feel a little.
Right. Shortly before 1 o'clock on October 29th in 1890 in Perry, Georgia, Tom was led out to the scaffold, where a small crowd of 10,000 men, women, and children had gathered to watch the execution.
But you said 10,000?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
That was a joke. Small crowd. Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Literal circus out there.
I'm sure.
There were, like, photographers waiting to snap a picture of him so they could sell them, so they could sell the shots, selling souvenirs. There were vendors there selling possum sandwiches.
Oh, my. I don't even know what to say to that. Okay.
I know. I'm just trying to imagine, like, how that would go down. Hey, honey, you and the kids get dressed. We're going to a hang-in, and don't worry about cooking.
We'll get some possum sandwiches while we're there.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, the crowd really expected Tom to break down and confess, knowing that he was about to die. Because I think that was pretty typical. Even criminals who had kind of held on to their innocence, when they knew that they were about to meet their makers, they went ahead and confessed.
Okay.
Instead, a statement was read aloud to the crowd that Tom had written the night before, and this was his final statement. I, Thomas G. Wolfwork, realizing the existence of an infinite, wise, and holy God, so as to meet him, knowing all I have ever done, and fully understand that I must stand before the judgment bar of God, and today, in a few hours, I shall be called into his presence, do solemnly declare my innocence, and that I leave as my last declaration that I did not take the life of my father or any other member of his family, or have any knowledge of the persons who did the murderous deed. Then Tom was allowed to say a prayer for himself and his sisters and all the people that had been good to him while he was in jail.
Okay.
After that, the black hood was pulled down over his face. The noose was put around his neck. At 1:31, the trap door fell, but the fall did not break his neck.
Ooh.
Tom very slowly strangled to death. It took him until 2:11 to stop breathing and to be cut down. That's 30 minutes.
Oh, that is horrible. That just seems very barbaric now. I mean, I know it was accepted then, but to think about that, to struggle.
That was the last public execution.
It was?
Yeah. I think it was hard for anybody.
Yeah. So like, in with that any state compassion or in the United States?
In Georgia.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess it did set a precedent. Maybe they decided at that point. I mean, 30 minutes. That's
a long time to watch somebody struggle.
For life.
And die. Yeah.
What a horrible death to die.
Yes. Oh. Yes.
Now, that said, if he actually did do it.
I know. I was thinking if he did do it, you know, and he's
guilty, then. Right. But if he didn't do it, that would even be way worse.
Tom, nicknamed Bloody Wolfwork by the press, was finally dead. They gave the rope that Tom was hanged on to George Howard, Maddie's brother, who cut it into pieces and gave them to members of the family. They said that he grieved his sister until the day that he died. I think they were a very close family, and he really wanted to see Tom pay for his sister's murder. He was he was strongly in favor of
He obviously did not believe Tom's admission that he did not.
No.
He didn't believe that.
Absolutely not. And, you know, I think that she had confided in her family some of the goings on in the house between her and Tom and the kids.
And so he actually just gave that pieces of that rope away like a souvenir.
Some descendants still have those pieces of rope.
Oh, that's creepy.
Yes, it is. So Tom's sisters had a plot at Orange Hill Cemetery in Hawkins, and that's where they buried Tom. So he has like a headstone, and it was actually vandalized, though, for a lot of years, but kind of, I think sentiments kind of changed towards him. Now, there are some twists to the story. Things are not always as cut and dry as they seem. For one thing, it turns out that despite how things looked on the outside, the captain wasn't really that well off financially. When he came back from the war, the captain opened up the first hardware store in Macon. He had several investors, and it did pretty good for a while. But eventually, his business went under. And that was really bad because he had his house and a lot of his land tied up in collateral.
Okay.
So he was about to lose
most
of what he had inherited. And it was around that time that he married Maddie. And I kind of feel like maybe that was a business move on his part. I think he grew to love her. I don't necessarily know that he started out loving her.
Okay. And so I wonder if did Tom know that his dad did not really have as much as he, you know, previously had bragged about and was counting on for his inheritance?
I'm not sure about that. I'm going to talk about that in just a second.
Okay.
So after he married Maddie, this is really, really interesting because Maddie's father, Ben Howard, helped the captain out by buying up his home and several pieces of that land that he would have lost. Then he turned around and gave it to his daughter.
Okay.
Put it in her name.
So it really would have been the stepmother's, Maddie's anyway. So Tom would not have gotten that.
No.
She or her children would have gotten that.
Absolutely.
So again,
and so the captain got to keep his place in society, but if he died, that most of what he had was going to Maddie. Now, he did still own some land, but not nearly as much as, you know, people would have thought.
Okay.
So if Tom killed Maddie and her kids, then of course it was going to go to her dad.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to go to Tom.
Yeah, so it does bring me back to that question. What did Tom know? That's what I'm wondering.
It does change things a little bit.
Well, yeah, it changes your perspective. You have it opens up more avenues and more questions about the motivation.
Right, right. And Tom may not have known that. You know, we have no way of knowing. The other thing was that although the captain was loved and respected in Macon society, he was not popular with the ex-slaves turned sharecroppers who worked for him. He kind of treated his employees like he didn't get the memo that slavery had ended.
Oh.
He would enforce really strict punishments for just kind of petty things. He had, on more than one occasion, young tenants sent to chain gangs over things like stealing wheat.
Yeah, so not the most gracious in man, was he?
No, he wasn't. And oftentimes the parents of these young men or, you know, boys that had been sent away, they didn't have any means to live and no choice, you know, but to stay and keep working for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the boys, when they were done with their time at the chain gang, had to go back there too.
Yeah.
And they weren't real happy with that.
So you can see lots of reasons for resentment there.
Absolutely. And even the captain himself and a lot of his fellow planters, they were really worried about retaliation. So there were not great feelings between the two at that time. So one man who felt wronged by and openly despised the captain was a man named, he was kind of young at this time, but his name was Simon Cooper. He was London Cooper's son. And London Cooper actually testified against Tom. But right after the murders, Simon up and left the Wolf Fork plantation. Then in 1897, five members of the Wilson family in Sumter County were brutally axed to death.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Simon Cooper put a man in the front yard as a lookout, and then he went inside and murdered five members of that family himself within just a few minutes with a short-handled axe, which is exactly what was used in the Wolf Folk murders.
Okay, hold up. So this same Simon Cooper has committed murder of a family with an axe.
Mm-hmm.
And he had previously worked for the Wolf Fork family.
Yep. He worked for them, you know, during...
When that happened.
Yes.
Yeah, that's... Okay, so that actually... that is a twist.
Yeah.
I'm trying to take all that in. That's a twist. Go ahead.
Simon was captured. Actually, it took several days, and there was a shootout. And it was crazy. He terrorized the black and white community. He wanted to marry this girl and she wouldn't marry him. And so he just went on a rampage, shooting people. He murdered six people and like seriously injured five. Yeah.
Wow.
So when he was, you know, when he was finally captured, a lynch mob overpowered the deputy, drugged Simon in the woods and killed him. So, and there was a black man who talked about what a monster Simon was, but he said that lynch mob made him a hero.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And of course, newspapers spoke out about the hang-in and condemned the mob, as they should have.
Yes.
Because we don't have a lot of answers today.
Right.
Because, you know, those guys trying to be manly men.
And taking that into their own hands.
Exactly. I mean,
yeah.
So after he was killed, a trunk that belonged to Simon with a journal inside was found. And he wrote in it bragging about how many times he'd gotten away with murder, just about all these different like criminal things that he had done. He hated white people. He had previously been a slave. Mm-hmm. So he was bitter.
Yeah.
But he was also just mean.
Yes. I was so convinced that Tom was guilty, but you are making me question that now. I'm like, oh, goodness, there's definitely another suspect who has motive, opportunity. Yeah.
There was one entry in particular that was really interesting, and it was talking about the Wolfork murders. It read, Tom Wolfork was mighty slick, but I fixed him. I would have killed him with the rest of the damn family, but he was not at home.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. So I'm thinking it was him. He did it. It had to be Simon.
I know. It's so crazy.
Okay. But before I'm still just taking that in. Like, okay, now I'm convinced Simon did it. And now I'm thinking and Tom hanged for it.
He did. The only thing. So it is a twist and it's so interesting, but there are a couple of things. First of all, I question the validity of that journal only because I don't think it was real common for slaves and young black sharecroppers to read and write very well.
Okay, that's a good point.
To have much of an education.
Yeah. So someone maybe could have planted that.
I wonder.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that.
Yeah.
And I do. We obviously we know that he was very violent. Mm-hmm. He did murder a family, you know, very similar to. So there are still a lot of circumstances there. But I do question the validity of that journal.
Yeah. Oh, crazy stuff.
Yeah. Very interesting. So what do you think?
If you I honestly don't even know what to think. I'm sitting here like with my mouth open, like, what? I don't know what to think, Darlene. I'm just like, wow. That is a sensational case. I'm going to have to process it for a while.
So, yeah, if any of you listeners have any idea what do you think? Who do you think murdered the Wolfork family?
Yeah, we'd like to hear.
Yeah. I mean, there's a good chance that Tom did it. But there's a good chance he didn't.
Right.
I don't know that he would have been convicted.
Well, people do get convicted based on circumstantial evidence.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I don't know.
I know. And there was a lot of circumstantial evidence.
Yeah. And it did. I mean, it did look bad for him. I mean, I had so many questions when you were telling his part of the story. But even though I had questions in my mind, I was convinced, oh, he did it.
Because, you know, I had a real hard time with that spot mm-hmm. in the bedroom that he had cleaned up. But actually later he said that he went in there and he did wash up after the murders and mm-hmm. told them that he was going to do that. So I don't know if he just had time to think about it and change his story. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
a lot of... A lot of stuff to process.
Yeah, And then again, I don't know if they suppressed some of what he was saying because they were absolutely convinced that he did it. Mm-hmm. And where I got the information that he said he didn't know about the clothes, like he couldn't remember, you know, where he threw the bloody clothes. Mm-hmm. And I got the information also about the spot on the floor, the wet spot. I got that from the newspaper and they were anti-Tom.
Okay. So all of the media was.
Oh, they, yes. There was nobody for him but his sisters, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wonder if any of them, not his supporters, but any of the people who are anti-Tom, I wonder if any of them changed their mind when they heard the stuff about the Simon Cooper guy who also could have.
I've heard that some of her descendants don't believe Tom did it now.
Okay.
Because a lot of them.
You would have to call that into question.
Right.
Now they both have opportunity.
Yes.
They both have the means. They both have the motivation.
So,
and we didn't have DNA back then, technology. I guess we probably did not have fingerprint technology. So,
right.
Yeah.
So, and we don't really know for sure how bad he hated, if it was all that bad with him and the family, because there was a thing called yellow journalism. Have you heard of that term?
No.
I mean, it was basically where they just sensationalized, you know, stories like this.
Oh, I think we still have that today.
Oh, we do. We do, for
maybe
sure.
We don't know the term, but I'm sure we still have that today.
It leaves me with, I don't know, more questions than answers.
Okay,
really.
Good, because that's how I feel. But if you feel that way too, then I'm like, okay, it's just the nature of that story in itself.
The real victims here, you know, were the Woolfolk family. And on August 7th, the morning after the murders, the captain, Maddie, Dick, Pearl, Annie, Charlie, Rosebud, and baby Maddie were brought to the Rose Hill Cemetery in a slow, somber funeral procession. Mm. There were 9 coffins carried by 5 horse-drawn hearses, and people lined both sides of the road the entire way to the cemetery.
Wow.
Pearl's college friends were out there crying and mourning the loss of their friend. And there were more than 2,000 spectators at the funeral or at the graveside when they got there. I want to leave you today to chew on the words of Reverend I.R. Bronham, who preached that morning at the family's funeral. These are his words.
Ladies and gentlemen, I can't think of a better place to begin than with the parable of the 10 virgins. For you know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh. And this comes this morning with a tremendous force. Spread out before us are 9 persons, from the infant to the grandmother, all of them stricken down without notice. That's the great concern for us all, is to be ready. So Christians, are all the hindrances that prevent your readiness gathered up and put out of the way? If the Master should come and call today, are you ready to rise and open to Him immediately? Is the doom of the soul forever sealed when the body dies? Oh, then let us rise from our apathy and plead with our fellow men, or with those who would stand upon the brink of a fathomless abyss. With 1 foot uplifted, ready to take a step, let us see to it that our daily accounts with God and our fellow men are balanced, and that we are ready at a moment's notice to make a settlement and go in peace. Turn an ear of your soul and listen to the silent warning that comes from these coffins, and may the Holy Spirit impress their mute message upon your hearts and upon that still small voice that guides us to a right standing with God.
Those were some hard times, and we'd like to thank y'all for listening to them with us, and we hope you thoroughly enjoyed it. Whether you loved it or just liked it a whole lot, do the girls a favor and review and rate it with a 5-star rating wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you have any questions or comments or recommendations for another story, you can message the girls at hardtimesandtruecrimes.com. Or follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Darlene and Melody will be back in 2 weeks with another true crime story. And remember, if you give us a 5-star rating, all your wildest dreams will come true.